Welcome to Kremlin File, Anton. It's wonderful, wonderful to have you here with us today.
Hello, and welcome. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, let's jump in, okay, into our conversation. We've seen a rise in the far right in Europe and also in the United States. And today we're going to be taking a deep dive into this issue and also what, let's say, the role that Russia has played in all of this. We'd like you to give us a little bit of a sense, okay, of the danger that this relationship also poses to global democracy. But let's take it one step at a time. Let's start with a little bit of background, okay, Anton, and then we'll move on, okay, from there. And from various articles that you've written also in your book, can you start by giving us a little bit of background into the far right and what their main goals are?
Well, if we're talking about the far right in the historical perspective, it's the movement mm-hmm. that was born in the beginning of the 20th century, mostly in Germany, but also in France. Then it spread, it was also born in Italy. Then it spread to other countries. Then, of course, it was the far right regimes installed in the Third Reich. Or in Germany, that mm-hmm. became the Third Reich, then in Italy with Benito Mussolini, then in some other countries mm-hmm. Known as fascist regimes. After the Second World War, the far right in Europe, at least, it had to evolve because basically, mm-hmm. Fascism was defeated, the Third Reich was defeated. So they had to somehow adopt new strategies. So they developed mostly during the Second World War, the far right evolved into three distinct forms. Some groups, very small fringe groups, they thought that they would continue this revolutionary struggle or suited revolutionary struggle to overcome the liberal democratic consensus. And I'm talking here about Western Europe, obviously, because Central Eastern Europe was mostly occupied by the Soviets or with their puppet regimes there. Mm-hmm. So the far right could not really exist mm-hmm. on those territories for a very long time. So I'm talking about Western Europe. So there were these groups, revolutionary groups, they were very, very small. The idea was to keep the flame of the fascist revolution burning. They basically never succeeded. There were other people who thought that they would not be able to repeat the history of the Third Reich in terms of coming to power. So they decided, and that was almost deliberate, they decided to translate the far right into the language of liberal democracy. They wanted to be more respectable. They wanted to be more acceptable. This is what became known as the contemporary forms of the party political far right or radical right wing populist parties. The far right, when we're talking with the far right today, it's rather we're talking about the radical right wing populist parties.
Yes.
And rise of those parties started to take place at the end of the 1980s in Western Europe. Then, of course, with the fall of the Soviet Empire, with the collapse of the socialist system in Central Eastern Europe, some far-right parties started to appear also in that part of the world. And they were actually quite different because they did not have those conditions in which the contemporary radical right-wing populist parties evolved. They did not face this idea that they had to translate anything into the liberal democratic language. Mm-hmm. So parties, far-right parties in Central and Eastern Europe were always more radical than their counterparts in Western Europe. And to some extent, when we're talking or when we're discussing the threat of the far right to liberal democracy, we should clearly distinguish two types. Even if we are talking about radical right wing populist party, we need to distinguish between two trends. One trend is the far right parties that are not going to get away from the sort of more radical extreme routes. Mm-hmm. And those parties, they do have problems. And I don't think that they pose a real threat, because they end up being either banned or somehow criminalized, like what we saw in Greece, for example, with the Golden Dawn. We also see similar developments in Slovakia with the Marian Kotleba's party, which is really extreme. It's basically a neo-fascist party. And they may have small successes, but they are definitely not going to win on the national level. The second trend is actual mainstreamization of the far right.
Right.
And and in some cases, these decisions are very pragmatic, mm-hmm. but many far right parties, they tend to become less extreme, less radical. And one explanation for this, well, two explanations. Well, one explanation is that people actually don't like radicals. This mm-hmm. is general observation. People prefer more moderate politicians, even when they are sort of fed up with either center wing or center right, center left. They tend to opt for less radical opposition in Europe. And
Anton, Putin purports to be a defender of the anti-globalist power, fighting for national sovereignty and self-determination. You've stated this is just a facade. What do you mean by it? And what is Putin's true ideology?
I think that Putin actually does not have any ideology. He has ideas, and those ideas are quite strong in his mind. One idea is that he wants Russia to be great, and he wants to be associated with Russia, with this Russian greatness. There is no ideology in this, because great Russia is not an ideology. It's not like liberalism or conservatives or fascism, communism. This is just an idea. He wants to have something like the Soviet Union. I think he's still a huge fan of the Soviet Union, not necessarily the communist ideology, but the idea that the Soviet Union was ruling the world together with the United States of America.
Yes.
So this idea that the Soviet Union was a great country, a global player, he wants Russia to transform Russia into something like this. The problem, of course, is the absence of ideology. And this has been raised many, many times, that, the Soviet Union, or the greatness of the Soviet Union, its position on the world was founded on the idea that it was the main promoter of a very specific ideology. It was not just the great country. It was also a great project of modernity. Because, communism, like fascism, like liberalism, these are projects of modernity. Anti-globalization is an idea that he uses as some sort of substitute for ideology. He also played a bit with conservatism in 2013, 2014. He was also talking about how it is actually not very good not to have an ideology. But the problem is that if Putin or the Kremlin or his circles, if they at any point establish some sort of ideology, they will become vulnerable to criticism on the ideological level. This is why they're trying to combine it. They're trying to take different points, different aspects from different ideologies and combine this chimera, which is not an ideology, but a chimera.
Yeah.
So this is why I'm saying that it's all a facade. But this is not to say that there are no ideas. There are ideas, many ideas. They would sometimes engage with particular real ideologies, to invite them to different talk shows, to other programs, somehow feed these ideas to the public. So there is a lot of there are sort of playing around different ideas and ideologies.
Right, right. Okay.
Interesting.
Hold on.
How is Russia supportive of far-right groups and objectives?
There are several lines of support, and I would distinguish three of them. First is the media support.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Russian media, especially Russian state-controlled media, such as RT or Sputnik, mm-hmm. They give the European far-right a platform that they lack in their own respective societies. For example, the French far-right cannot have the same positive coverage, or at least neutral coverage, yeah. of their activities in the French mainstream media, while they can always rely on the Russian media to give that coverage. Then there is also political support. Again, the French example, when Marine Le Pen in 2017 went to Russia to meet with Putin, just 1 month before the first round of the presidential elections in France. And that was clear political support given to Le Pen from the Kremlin. Basically, yep. It was the message, absolutely. She is our candidate. Mm-hmm. She is our preferred candidate. There are also cases of financial support. Although we don't know much about this due to the clandestine nature of this support, but I want to mention here, note here, that support for the far right coming from the Kremlin is always sort of a plan B. The Kremlin does prefer to cooperate with mainstream forces. It's also about sending a message to the mainstream. So if you don't cooperate with us, we will cooperate with your enemies. Then there is also a very general dislike of the mainstream of liberal democracy in the Kremlin. Of course, they know that the far right in many countries, they are in the opposition, that they have fewer chances to come to power. But still, they believe in many cases there are there is this overlap in ideas between the Kremlin and far right groups. When they need, for example, some friendly election observers, they would engage with the far right. At least it was the case
in Crimea.
It was the case in Crimea.
Exactly. Now, with these kind of groups where we even have, let's say a little more mainstream to far right, okay, that whole spectrum, all right, one of the things their stated goals is to, let's say, break up the European Union, or at least, to get it into a lot of trouble. Let's just put it that way. And we're seeing a lot of secessionist movements, right, that are popping up, okay, all over the place. Already we've had, one nation, the UK, okay, who has, that has separated, okay, from the European Union. And we're going to be getting into a lot of detail with that in another episode. But broadly speaking, what are the geopolitical implications if the EU and the US are further weakened, by the actions from these groups?
I think in the result, they would have Russia. So let me put it this way. One of the reasons why Russia is doing this is that it cannot really become great again without weakening its adversary.
Somebody else, right.
So there is no enough power in Russia itself to become greater. It's just not possible.
Nope.
So you can only become great again if your adversary is weakened. And the adversary of Russia is obviously the US in the first place. The EU is a bit different. It is an adversary, but just because it is aligned with the US. Moreover, While there is this rejection of, I think, of the United States as such, of its culture, of its politics, in the Kremlin, there is a feeling that Europe today fails to be Europe. So Russia positions itself, you know, Moscow positions itself as the real Europe, as the Europe that has to be, you know, without multiculturalism, without those whining liberals, et cetera, et cetera. It's like the real, you know, the real Europe. So at the same time, the Kremlin would never say that we are the real United States, because the rejection of America is so deep that they would never say that. And they don't want to be another United States. Maybe in greatness, yes, but not in the, you know, not in culture, not in politics.
Sure.
But with Europe, yes. So while the US is the absolute adversary for Putin's regime, Europe is not. And there is, I think, even struggle sort of, you know, for Europe's soul that Russia believes that it is engaged in this struggle to free Europe from the American influence, to return Europe to what it used to be. Like to, and Russia would here be the main driving force of this, you know, return of Europe to its, you know, to its roots, so to say.
Yeah, and Russia, I mean, going back to Soviet days, I mean, the only thing in the headlines is always, you know, America's about to attack, whether it's 1970s or today. I mean, I checked Russian news this morning, and it's like they're breaking news. U.S. is preparing to brainwash Eastern European countries. I'm like, oh, okay. So, I mean, they're always on a war footing and, you know, and they need an enemy for internal purposes because, you know, how else are they going to sell their lack of services to their citizens without, you know, selling the idea that they're protecting them from this, you know, enemy. Going back to the far right, have you, like, what do you see the overlap between Russian intelligence agencies and far right groups as far as, you know, providing support, disinformation campaigns, and, you know, and basically all the other tactics that Russian intelligence operations involve?
There are, of course, many actors on the Russian side who are engaged in cooperation with the far right. I agree with you that Russian intelligence is one of those actors. It's not the only one. Probably it's not even the main one, but it's one of the many. Because you also have, you know, businessmen who are interested in cooperating with the far right in Europe and then selling their successes to the Kremlin in exchange for some resources. But yeah, intelligence, yes. And I think it's mostly about disinformation. It's mostly about injecting particular narratives into the media space of European societies. At the same time, we do have cases, really strange cases, and they may be results of the work of Russian intelligence, but it just, there is not enough proof to even speculate about this.
And then going back to, like, for instance, the recent case of, you know, going back to the secessionist movements, we see, for instance, you know, the California exit movement, Cali exit, the founder who is living in Russia now, who was behind setting up this movement for California to secede, he left to Russia. And now he's coming back, apparently, before elections next year to, again, restart this whole California secessionist movement. We saw his ties with, you know, Russia and with Russian agencies. Same with Catalonia. We saw the report come out, and over the past year, it's been trickling out. I remember last year, they said that GRU agents were sent to Catalonia to help separatists, and then Russia offered like 10,000 plus troops to help the separatists. And then now we see a fuller picture of the recent report that came out. So can you speak to that? I mean, how prevalent is that, and how much should Europe worry about something like that?
In most cases, I think actually European counterintelligence is aware of those operations. And what's happening is the problem is that sometimes they don't really react to the threats posed by Russian intelligence. So, for example, in Austria, I think there is much that Austrian authorities prefer not to talk about. And again,
Anton, why though?
Austria is a neutral country, and neutrality is part of their national character. Austria positions itself as a bridge between the West and the East. Obviously, this is this is ridiculous because Austria is part of the West. even if it's not part of NATO, it's part of the European Union. Right. It's during the Cold War. Again, despite the economic contacts with the Soviet Union, Austria was firmly in the West. However, Austria does not have ambitions to be, a global player. It's not like Germany. It's not like France. It's not like Italy. Its foreign policy is, I would say, underdeveloped, and they want to cooperate with everyone. So the level of tolerance of the Austrian authorities towards Russian malign operations is very, very high. It's not like in Scandinavia, for example, when they see some Russian malign operations, they're basically intolerant because the level of tolerance is very low. In Austria, it's quite different. There are very strong connections, business connections, financial connections between Austria and Russia. So they think that they don't want to jeopardize those contacts, those connections. And they prefer to keep quiet. One example here is the most recent attacks, like, Havana Syndrome in Vienna. And the attacks were against American diplomats, and basically, I think also spies who are stationed in Vienna. And those cases were second biggest attacks after Cuba. And there was very little coverage in the Austrian media, and the Austrian authorities prefer not to. Not to talk about this, not to mention this. Their understanding, we know that Vienna is the capital of espionage. We know that some spies are working against other spies, but we don't want to have anything with this. Despite the fact that basically it's happening on the Austrian soil.
Yeah.
But they say, it's not our business. You do whatever you want, just don't engage with us,
The past decade, we've seen an increase in protest. And even more recently, it's become really a big focus beginning over the past few years with we saw the yellow vest in France. We see White Lives Matter movements. We see massive anti-immigration movements, especially before elections. Anti-vax now, anti-mask, reopen protest. How do you think the Kremlin is involved with these protests? And besides disinformation, and on the disinformation front, we see them spreading these protests. And for instance, we had protests in DC last year with Black Lives Matter. A million people gathered peacefully, and they will find the one altercation and replay it over internally and then through social media. And a lot of times we even see them altering the content. One of their, offshoot outlets I saw was passing protest in Portland, passing around the video that they made go viral of Portland citizen setting a police officer on fire, but that actual video had happened in Mexico. So how often do you see this altered content? And, you know, and besides disinformation, what else is Russia doing to fuel these movements, these protests?
Well, as for the Yellow Vest movement, it obviously started without any support from Russia. It's a, you know, it's a domestic process in France. However, at some point, Russian politicians, Russian officials decided that they would engage with at least some parts of the Yellow Vest movements, and they even invited them to Moscow to have talks, mm-hmm. to discuss. Well, we don't know the content of their discussions, but we know of the fact that they were invited to Moscow to talk about something. And the person who invited them, Leonid Slutsky, who is the chair of the International Affairs Committee in the Russian parliament, he is known for actively taking part in Russian malign influence operations in Europe. So I don't think that they talked about cultural exchange or, you know, anything like this. Yeah.
No. So, over coffee or exactly, oh, cafe.
Vodka. Exactly.
Vodka. Sorry.
Go ahead.
Yeah,
sorry.
So we see some of these contacts, obviously, and especially when it concerns the US, it less so for Europe. The Kremlin or the, you know, the media or its propaganda network, it's what they're doing, it's all about making trouble in the US. It doesn't really matter who to support. The far right, the far left, it's, you know, it's about making problems. It's about, you know, again, making trouble. It's a bit different in with Europe because, again, for the reasons that I described in the mindset of the Kremlin, there are different, there are huge differences between the US, which is an absolute adversary, and Europe. So in Europe, it's they are looking at for example, public opinion polls. They are trying to monitor the situation in European societies and see who is likely to win in the next elections, whose political force is most popular then. And then would the Russians be able to cooperate with those new forces that are on the rise or whatever? So they're constantly monitoring this evolving situation. And if there are protests, if there is some protest movement, they always take into consideration their contacts with the ruling forces. With the ruling, you know, with the ruling parties. So, for example, if they do have good relations with the mainstream, they would are unlikely to support the protests. This is what I think we see again in Austria. There is an anti-vax movement. It's not extremely strong, but even if it was strong, I don't think that the Moscow would try to somehow, you know, fuel it, because they already have good relations with the authorities. So why would they try to undermine them?
Okay.
They didn't really cooperate with the Freedom Party of Austria, which is a far right party. Because why would they do this if they already have good relations with the two major parties? Exactly.
Okay.
So it's always about, you know, looking at different aspects of the political situation in every particular country. Another thing is that playing with the anti-vax sentiments is actually sort of a double-edged sword for Russia, because it has its own
backfired problems
with the anti-vax sentiments in Russia itself. So and you can see this clearly with that the problems that Russia has at home, it will, you know, think twice before promoting a message, you know, somehow deepening those problems in the West. And the COVID pandemic, COVID-19 pandemic, is a very good example here. In spring last year, when the pandemic emerged,
It was raging.
There was some controversy in the Russian media, state controlled media, about COVID. There was even in this program of Nikita Mikhalkov. I think he's a quite popular Russian film director. And in one of his programs on TV, he was pushing one of the conspiracy theories about the COVID pandemic, and his program was closed down because the Russian authorities realized that, well, COVID is not only a problem for the West, for the US, or for Europe. It's also a huge problem for Russia
internally.
So yeah, so they were quite strict about those conspiracy theories. It's a different thing that they tried to exploit the pandemic, for example, by sending so-called humanitarian aid to Serbia and Italy. And they made a huge thing about this, about, you know, sending those airplanes to
and
Italy.
And US.
Saying that, well, NATO is not helping Italy, but we are helping. Yeah. We're such great friends. And also they tried to undermine Western vaccines, trying to promote its own Sputnik V vaccine. But also, they at some point they realized that by undermining the trust into the Western vaccines and communicating this distrust, and also in Russian language, they were at the same time simultaneously undermining Russians' trust into Sputnik V vaccine. So they're actually quite cautious about the thing that can, you know, backfire.
Yeah,
they learned like very quickly with that this year. I mean, they're still continuing with disinformation, but internally, I mean, you know, the COVID pictures are not good at all. And the trust for the vaccine, I mean, Russians are generally don't trust the government, especially with vaccines. And on top of this disinformation, I mean, they now definitely are hesitant to take the vaccine.
Yeah. Anton, from what we're getting, okay, from this conversation, right, you're saying that Russia has, let's say, this array of all the European, and the West, and it adapts to each country depending if they're friendly, if they're not friendly, who to send funding to or support through, their own information, environments, so on and so forth. Now, they're doing all of this. What's the end game, Anton? What does Russia want in the end?
Russia wants two things. One thing is, actually, it has nothing to do with the West as such. Russia wants to keep the regime in power as long as possible, preferably forever. They want this regime that they built, Putin's regime, to survive as long as possible. They understand at the same time, that it cannot really survive in the environment where the West, being economically, probably also politically stronger than Putin's Russia, they understand that in this environment, it's not really possible for this regime to survive. Hence, they need to weaken what they believe is their adversary. This is the reason why they're doing this, because they want to keep this regime. They want to conserve it. They want to last forever, or as long as people in power live. This is what they do. The second reason is that they, as any country in the world, Russia has its own national interests. What they believe national interests are. And again, in order to promote their national interests in the competitive space, in the international competitive space, they understand that they have to weaken their competitors in order to advance their national interests. And again, this is what they're doing. Yes. And what I'm saying is that some of the interests, yeah, say Russia has national interests, so does any other country in the world. The problem here is that Putin's Russia sees the world as where the game is always like it's a zero sum game. If you don't win, you necessarily lose. They don't have this conception that actually it can be a win-win situation for everyone.
No.
And this is, I think, part of the liberal democratic consensus in a way, that we don't need to defeat our competitors, that they are, you know, lying on the ground and cannot do anything. We actually can, you know, have some compromise through diplomacy, through, you know, traditional ways of influence other nations. This is not the same for Putin's regime. This is a zero-sum game all the time. If we don't win, then we lose. And I think there is this psychological trauma, of course, you know, coming from the collapse of the Soviet Union. This is where it comes from. This, the, you know, this belief that the Cold War ended. There were these competing forces, the capitalist West and the communist East, and it all ended with the communist East losing the Cold War. This is where the psychological trauma comes from. So they have this understanding, or they have this feeling that this time, if we lose, then we lose. So, and it's just a very different approach to competition that they have.
Okay. How much of this is also to protect how much money there, the, let's say, Putin's people are taking away from Russia and hiding in the West?
Yeah, of course. This is also about protection of their own economic interests. That's for sure. I don't think that, you know, Putin himself is very much interested in financial gain here. As a man who owns the country, for whom entire Russia is his pocket. He doesn't really need.
Right.
And there was discussion a couple of...
So it's a means for power.
But he's not...
This is a means that he wields power this way. This is how he... It's not the actual money itself, but it's the representation, what it represents.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I think he's mostly driven by the considerations that I mentioned in the very beginning. It's about, you know, his ideas. And he's in the age where money, I mean, he has money. This is not, money is not a problem for him.
No.
For him, now is the most important thing, is to have and protect his place in history of Russia. He associates himself with Russia. By making Russia what he feels is great, he also, you know, he makes himself great. This is an idea that he has. So it's not, in my opinion, this is not about money as such. He did build a kleptocracy, but in the end, he's using this kleptocracy for his own very personal, goals and aims of a person who wants to keep his place in history.
Yeah, Anton is very correct, because, I mean, it's hard for people to understand in the West, but if you come from the Soviet Union and you're in that mentality, you know, I mean, even, you know, someone who sells bread for a living has this, you know, proud, like mentality, like this hardliner Soviet mentality of Russia, like, well, the Soviet Union is great and the West is bad and, you know, we're powerful and, you know, and it's hard to explain it here, but like this, a lot of it, I mean, comes from, you know, the Soviet hardliner mentality, and even the people surrounding Putin, you know, are from that time, you know?
Yeah. Anton, where can our listeners find out more about your work?
I have a website. Actually, there is this website, Tango Noir. It's not really updated at the moment, although I sometimes write a blog here. And also, last year, I founded an NGO in Austria called Center for Democratic Integrity, amazing. Which I'm trying to develop and publish some things under this brand.
Okay, so we'll be following
and we'll
there.
List thank it on our website for our listeners.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. So thank you. Thank you,
Anton.
For
thank
all
you.
The information that you shared.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Hey, everybody. If you enjoyed this podcast, don't forget to subscribe and please visit our website, KremlinFile.com. This is Season 1, Kremlin File, hosted by Olga Lautman and me, Monica Mata. This is a Bunker Crew Media production with executive producers Marley Clements, Jack Bryan, Grant DeSimone, Ben Brett, and Jordi Mycelis of Midas Media, with associate producers Ruby Frankel and Sarah Metz. Theme music by Oreste Camarna. Sound editing and mixing by Joy Ellett. Subscribe to Kremlin File wherever you listen to podcasts.